This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Immigration policy you might not have heard about. Tax policy you've quite possibly heard about but don't quite possibly understand because tax policy. And a video game you have definitely heard about. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, September the very 1st. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This is going to sound like a curious thing to say, I admit in advance, but it is important in this particular and very unusual election year to remember that there are actually two major party candidates running for the highest office in the land. And with Donald Trump having sucked all the air out of the immigration debate the past 24 hours and gotten all the press coverage, a word here about the Democrat in the race. Hillary Clinton, contra Mr. Trump, calls for a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants and an extension of some of President Obama's existing policies. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer gets us going.
Here's what Hillary Clinton says she would do. Introduce comprehensive immigration reform within her first 100 days in office and keep current policies that try to protect some immigrants from deportation, like so-called dreamers, people who were brought here illegally when they were children. That's what Clinton emphasizes when she meets with undocumented immigrants. She tells them,
I will defend those and I will absolutely protect your children, yourself, and try to bring your family back together.
This is basically an extension of President Obama's current policy. In his first term, he was much stricter on immigration. He deported more people than any other president in decades, even his predecessor, says Stephen Yale Lair, who teaches immigration law at Cornell University Law School.
President Obama deported more people in his first administration than President Bush had done under his administration.
According to the Migration Policy Institute, President Obama deported around 3 million people, and that's not cheap. Randy Capps is the Institute's Director of Research for U.S. Programs.
The government spent $19 billion on immigration enforcement versus about $15 billion on all other federal criminal law enforcement agencies.
Capps says President Obama ratcheted down immigration enforcement in his second term, but there are still lots of U.S. border agents on patrol, according to Edward Alden, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
You now have roughly 21,000 Border Patrol agents, which is a doubling from the level of the early 2000s when it was around 10,000.
Our next president, Clinton or Trump, would inherit all of those agents. One difference, Hillary Clinton says she would extend President Obama's softer policies. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Apple CEO Tim Cook, it seems, has a fairly limited set of talking points when challenged about his company's overseas tax practices. When questioned by an Irish newspaper today about that whopper of a tax bill that Apple got from the European Union this week, Mr. Cook repeated what he told CBS's Charlie Rose late last year, that it is, quote, total political crap. Be that as it may, Mr. Cook did also say that the company plans to repatriate, quoting again, several billion dollars in overseas profits next year. Believe me when I tell you, however, that that is not going to be a straightforward tax transaction. Adam Allington has that story.
Among global tech companies, Apple is without peer. It has the highest revenue, $233 billion, highest profit, $53 billion, market cap, you get the picture, which means they'd have a huge U.S. tax bill if they were forced to pay the 35% corporate tax rate here. But don't hold your breath, says Bill Gale, co-director of the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center.
I'm virtually certain Apple is not going to end up paying 35% on all of its profits going forward.
Gale says if Apple does end up paying $14 billion in back taxes to the EU, that amounts to a $14 billion tax credit stateside. So with that, they can repatriate some profits without incurring new tax. In the future, Gale thinks Apple will find some other way to lower their tax bill, such as maybe waiting for a corporate tax holiday like we saw back in 2004, when companies got a one-time rate of 5.2%. Hunter Blair from the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute says these kinds of fixes only make the problem worse.
As soon as they see a tax holiday where they were able to only pay 5% on those profits instead of the full 35% that they owe, in the future, they think about that and they say, hey, we should put more of our profits offshore.
At the heart of the issue, says Blair, is a tax loophole that allows corporations to defer paying taxes in the first place.
So a fix looks like you want to close the deferral loophole that's allowing them to continue to stash all these profits offshore.
Apple CEO Tim Cook plans to appeal, saying he disputes Brussels' math, igniting a further political standoff. In Washington, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, I've been saying it all week, y'all. Jobs report tomorrow. Until then, nothing doing. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are few things more valuable for farmers out here in the West than water. Almost nothing more valuable, really. And if your farm happens to be near a fast-growing city, that water and the rights to it are all the more precious and can bring a nice price. Luke Runyon from KUNC in Colorado reports that some well-positioned farm families are making millions.
This auction house in Loveland, Colorado, near Denver, is packed. Bidders, some in cowboy hats, some in business suits, mingle over coffee. Auctioneer Spanky Assiter, yes, that's his real name, takes the mic and lays out what's at stake.
Today's an opportunity to buy water. Today's an opportunity.
An opportunity to buy water. That's pretty rare here on the High Plains. And today, a lot of water is up for grabs.
Farming is a tough operation these days.
That's the farm's owner, Scotty Reynolds. She's decided to retire, and she's putting her 400-acre farm up for sale. It sits just 40 miles from Denver, one of the fastest-growing metro areas in the country. But the land isn't the big prize. It's the irrigated water that flows into the fields from a system of reservoirs in the nearby Rocky Mountains.
The land and the water have become more valuable than the income from farming.
Here we go, ladies and gentlemen. It's up for auction.
And with that, the Reynolds farm is for sale.
Here we go. There, now an opportunity to be.
Bids pour in for the water rights, some fetching $27,000 a share, more than double the cost a decade ago. The actual amount of water fluctuates year to year, depending on how full reservoirs are. The bids come in fast and furious. And when all said and done, the water rights sell for a combined $10 million. The land went for just $3 million. By far, the biggest spenders were cities. Melanie Calvert purchases water rights for Broomfield, a growing Denver suburb.
It's not cheap, but you only pay for it once. You buy it once and you get it forever.
Today, Calvert shelled out $3.2 million of taxpayer money on water rights. Increasingly, water is more sought after for lawn sprinklers and bathroom faucets than growing hay for cows. Calvert knows there's a lot of angst in the farming community about cities buying water, drying up farmland, and putting in condos. But cities have water needs, too.
No one's twisting anyone's arm. I'm not trying to get anyone to close down their farm or anything like that. It's, you know, if you want to sell your water, come and talk to me.
That kind of talk could appeal to farmers like Kent Pepler. He farms a half mile down the road from the auctioned farmland. These days, he's often driving his tractors through suburban neighborhoods to plant and harvest his crops.
I've been feeling penned in for quite a few years right now, so it won't be a new feeling for me.
Pepler says more of his farming neighbors are paying attention to auctions like this. Million-dollar checks are tempting, even for multi-generational farm families.
If the commodity prices stay low, then definitely this will be a benchmark for people to think about.
The auctioned farm's owner, Scotty Reynolds, admits it stings to sell the land and water. But with no family member wanting to take over the farm, And with water bringing record high prices, now's the time to take advantage.
History proves that change comes, whether we are happy with it or not.
And that's a lesson most farmers in the West already know all too well. In Fort Collins, Colorado, I'm Luke Runyon for Marketplace.
There is, it turns out, an accepted definition for that part of this planet's landmass known as the Russian Far East, roughly from Lake Baikal in eastern Siberia to the Pacific Ocean. It's about a third or so of the entire country is the important part land-wise, but home to a mere 6 million people, 4% of the Russian population. Russia being Russia, though, the government in Moscow has a plan to fill those wide-open spaces. The BBC's Marie Keyworth reports.
Olga Smorozhina has lived in Kaiman Ribolov her whole life. It's a place so quiet, people here insist on calling it a village, even though it's really a small town of 22,000 people.
It's not a very big town, but it has its history, and people that live here, they are very pleasant. And when I was in a big town, it was a great difference between our place and between the town.
Deep in the countryside, in the far-flung east of Russia, it sits on the edge of the vast Lake Hunka, 200 kilometers north of Vladivostok.
Agriculture is the main stream of our people. They are not very rich, of course, but it's our life.
But that life here is in danger. Jobs in agriculture are falling and the village is shrinking. And it's not just Kaiman Ribolov that's getting smaller. The population of the whole far east of Russia is decreasing. And it's why the government has just made a new law. It entitles every Russian citizen to a hectare of land in the far east for free. For 3 months, people from the far eastern regions have been able to apply for unused government land by filling out a form on the internet.
We've just walked a little bit along the edge of Lake Hunka. It's a tiny little cliff drop down into the water, and we're standing in a very beautiful, gladed, wooded area. This is a place where people have managed to attain this land for free.
But back on the mean city streets of Vladivostok, how much do people even want this land in the first place?
No, because I know this land very bad and very hard work.
Actually, I don't think about that seriously, but I think it's a good idea maybe for other guys who really want it and who maybe comes from villages. I won't live in city.
Anton Hiroshkov is 27 and he has chosen some free land, and it's close to a federal highway. He's actually clubbed together with friends and they want to start a shop, getting business from trucks traveling between Russia and China.
We decided to get this land when we heard about the law, because it really allows people to do whatever kind of business they want. Those who believe in their powers will use this project and will move to Far East.
Back in Kaiman Ribolov, the project has been more of a headache than a boost for the local administration. And the dusty streets of this isolated outpost may hold little appeal for Russia's city slickers.
The BBC's Marie Keyworth. Coming up.
For fun, he wanted to try to recreate a childhood game, a puzzle game called Pentominoes.
The result was a little game you might have heard of. It's called Tetris. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 18 points today, 10%, 18,419. The NASDAQ increased 13 points, 0.25%, 52.27. The S&P 500 basically unchanged. We talked about Apple and repatriating some of that money to the U.S. Apple polished up 0.5%. Microsoft advanced 0.2%. Campbell's is blaming small carrots in part for disappointing quarterly results. The company, which has been emphasizing fresh produce lately, apparently harvested carrots prematurely. Customers apparently like them bigger. Campbell sliced 6.25% today. That might be the best item in numbers ever.
I don't know. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.56%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This was not a good morning for Elon Musk and his Let's Eventually Take Humankind to Mars company. It's called SpaceX. One of their rockets exploded on the launch pad at Cape Canaveral during a routine test this morning. Nobody was hurt, which is always good. But an Israeli communications satellite was destroyed, and this makes it the second rocket that SpaceX has lost in a little bit more than a year. As I said, not so good for SpaceX. Maybe not so bad, though, for the growing private space industry. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that one.
A little after 9 a.m. Eastern, the Falcon 9 rocket seemed like it was all set. In preparation for its commercial launch Saturday, the company ignited the rocket's 9 engines, kind of cleaning out the pipes. SpaceX always does this. Today, something went wrong. For the briefest second, fire lights up all 226 feet of the Falcon 9. It's like an X-ray of the ship. And then the rocket and its $195 million satellite were gone. In a statement, the company said the explosion was due to an anomaly.
There's always inherent risk with rocket launches. That's just a part of the game.
Rebecca Keller is an analyst with Stratfor. A number of private firms have lost rockets, including Virgin Galactic, Orbital ATK, and Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin. Keller says this could harm SpaceX. But more broadly, in the wake of this disaster, how much tolerance do rocket company customers, like telecom companies, have for these fits and starts? Space.com managing editor Tariq Malik says more than you might think.
It seems like the business case is being made now for commercial launch services, and so it seems like investors are a bit more willing to back some of those ventures.
Malik says companies like SpaceX and Blue Origin can afford to withstand setbacks because they're owned by ambitious billionaires. More sustainably, customers from NASA to the U.S. military to telecom firms have a growing desire to get into space. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Random but interesting fact about that satellite that blew up this morning. Dan was talking about ambitious billionaires. Mark Zuckerberg had bought some of that satellite's capacity to run internet.org on. That's Facebook's big project to get connectivity out to areas and people that, for whatever reason, can't otherwise get online. Speaking of online, this item today, which comes to us courtesy of the word demonetization, it seems that YouTube, which is owned by Google, which is owned by Alphabet, has changed how it notifies the people who make the videos that go on YouTube about which of said videos are advertiser-friendly. YouTubers large and small have been reporting a slew of demonetizations, topics that could be out of bounds ad-wise, too little clothing, too much violence, cussing, and, this is a quote, controversial topics like, and this is another quote, war, political conflicts, natural disasters, and tragedy. So if you want to make a YouTube video about that hurricane about to hit Florida or the 2016 election, maybe it's not going to make any money. All right, moving on. If you thought the movie business was all about, you know, the actual movies with a bit of popcorn and concession stand sales thrown in on the side, not so fast. A report from the Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association says global sales of licensed merchandise, knickknacks, toys, clothing, you name it, that refers to movies, TV shows, sports teams, and all the rest, those sales were up almost $10 billion last year over a year earlier. Star Wars did come out last year, so yeah, that helped. But $10 billion worth? Marketplace's Andy Euler has more now on just how much of the entertainment industry is tied to licensing these days.
So I was walking around the office today talking about the movie Minions. You know, the little yellow animated guys who got their own feature film last year. A colleague told me that her 3-year-old son has a couple of their stuffed toys. He and thousands of other kids. But then she told me he's never actually seen the movie.
But that's not generally the way it works.
Brian Sheehan teaches advertising at Syracuse University.
They are, in and of themselves, outrageously cute. There are times, I think, like Minions, where you can have something that works in and of itself as a doll, whether there was a movie or not.
Licensing is going further and further these days. Greg Battersby is general counsel for the Licensing Industry Merchandisers Association, the group that put out the report. He says back in the 60s, it was pretty simple.
There was an association between something seen in the movies and something which the kid would ultimately buy at a toy store or in an apparel or what have you.
Today's licensing industry is bigger. It's far beyond toys. There's even a license for an original paint color, Minion Yellow that was released a full 3 months before the movie premiered. Brian Sheehan says now a movie comes out,
and then that starts to extend itself into a million different platforms, some physical like a doll and some digital.
So the next time your kids go to a movie, they might not only be asking for a cute doll afterward. Don't be surprised when they ask you to buy the app for their tablet, too. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
On the theory that showing is better than telling, let me play a little something here just to set up this next story. Here you go. So, distinctly Russian flavor, right? Also vaguely video game-ish. It's the Tetris theme song. Chances are you've played that game on your computer or on a Game Boy, maybe on your phone. But the story of how Tetris came to be, that is where we get to the Russian music. The story is told in Dan Ackerman's new book. It's called The Tetris Effect, the game that hypnotized the world. Dan, it's good to talk to you.
Good to be here.
It should be noted as we get going here that this game was invented by a guy in the Soviet Union, basically fiddling around with an extremely outdated computer, even by Soviet 1980 standards, right?
Yeah, Alexei Pajitnov was a researcher and a programmer at the Russian Academy of Sciences, and they had access to, you know, outdated computers, but as the best you could get there at the time. He actually worked on some very forward-looking things about artificial intelligence, about speech recognition, but for fun, he wanted to try to recreate a childhood game, a puzzle game called Pentominoes that you've probably seen with these little plastic or wooden or cardboard pieces you fit into a box perfectly. And Tetris was his way of recreating that on the primitive computer equipment that he had.
And when did it first come to the attention of the West, the Americans, the Europeans, and the people who eventually went running to Moscow to say, ooh, we got to get a piece of this? When did that happen?
Very unusually, the game sort of went viral. You couldn't, like, send it to anyone over the internet. There was no internet back then, especially not in Moscow. You had to sneaker net it, which is when you put something on an old-fashioned floppy disk and you walk it over to somebody else and say, here you go. And people kept doing that. They kept making copies, and it went around Moscow and around other cities, eventually to other Eastern Bloc nations, ended up in Hungary, where a guy who was a software exporter from the UK saw some people playing it at a school and said, hey, this actually looks pretty cool. I should see if I could find the rights somehow to get the software and to sell it in the West.
And it eventually becomes a race, a contest between two companies, one called MirrorSoft and the other one, a tad better known, Nintendo, right?
And MirrorSoft was really a part of a big group called the Mirror Group, which was a big media conglomerate headed by a guy named Robert Maxwell, who back in the 80s was sort of the Rupert Murdoch of his day. The two of them were actually tabloid newspaper rivals. And after kind of a roundabout way of getting the program out of the Soviet Union, said, we don't know how to ask the Russians about intellectual property rights. They're not going to understand this. Let's just sort of just start making deals for it and roll the dice and see what happens. And then Nintendo wanted to try to find it and put it on their top secret new project they were working on called the Game Boy, a little thing you might have heard of. So everyone had to race to Moscow basically during the same week and try to track down the secretive Soviet trade group, which was named ELORG, which kind of sounds like a James Bond villain organization that could technically sign the contract because they figured out that nobody else really could.
And it is a little cloak and daggerish, this week running around Moscow. I mean, you talk about it a lot in the book, and it's, let's remember, 1989, Russia, it's the evil empire. Things are still very Soviet, but falling apart. It's an interesting time over there.
I mean, that's how we get into sort of the guy who's probably the main protagonist of the book, a guy named Hank Rogers. And he teamed up with Nintendo to try to get those rights for this upcoming Game Boy handheld. He just shows up and hopes he can talk his way through the door.
Do you remember the first time you played this game?
It's got to be the original Game Boy version that I think I played and my mother played at the same time, and we had to kind of trade the old school black and white Game Boy back and forth. And that's sort of a great case of a piece of hardware and a piece of software having this perfect synergy, because when you bought the Game Boy, Tetris came in the box, and they just proved to be the perfect partners for each other.
Who's the big winner then out of this? Is it Nintendo, do you think?
Originally, it was Nintendo because they not only got the rights to put Tetris cartridges in the Game Boy, which was still a new and unproven business back in the late 80s, they eventually circled back and got the rights for all the other living room consoles, the Nintendo Entertainment System, which was big in the U.S., the Famicom, which was their version of that in Japan. So that's the initial winner. But I'm pleased to say that years later, Alexei Pajitnov, our friend who programmed originally on his own in Moscow, after the Soviet Union collapsed, he and Hank Rogers maintained a friendship all these years, and Hank helped him get his share of the rights back. And today, the two of them are co-owners of the brand, which still operates as the Tetris Company.
So he's made some money then, yeah?
He has definitely made some money.
Dan Ackerman has a new book out. It is called The Tetris Effect, The Game That Hypnotized the World. Dan, thanks very much for your time.
Great to be here.
First of all, you're welcome for the earworm for the rest of the day. Second of all, this final note on the way out, courtesy of the Atlantic and the bananas state of American politics circa 2016. The Federal Election Commission has about had it with the, shall we say, creative ways that people have filed to run for president this year. It is not hard to do, file, that is, and lots of people do it every year. And this year, clearly anything goes. So there are papers on file for Darth Vader, Anakin Skywalker, who are actually the same person, by the way, Jean-Luc Picard, Captain Crunch, Queen Elsa, and Frances Underwood. Also this from a letter from the FEC dated yesterday, too, and this is a quote from the address, H. Majesty Satan, Lord of Underworld, Prince of Darkness, exclamation point. Also, both Satan and God filed to run as Republicans. Do with that what you will. All right, gotta go. Jobs Day tomorrow, which means the Dow and all the rest, they'll do something. The Dow up 18 points today at 10%. The NASDAQ up 13 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 basically unchanged. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.